Greetings, listeners. My name's Andrew Fullerton, and with me is Bevan Ramsden. In this podcast produced by IPAN, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, we examine the question of why Australia is so wealthy, and yet so many Australians are increasingly suffering hardship.
We have golden soil and wealth for toil. Our home is girt by sea. Our land abounds in nature's gifts. So goes our national anthem. But the truth is that while our country has immense natural resources and potential wealth, the vast majority of Australians derive little or no benefit from this bounty, with increasing numbers struggling to survive.
Quite right, Bevan. Homelessness, for example, is rising. Data from the 2021 census shows that over 122,000 people in Australia were homeless on census night, a figure that has likely increased. Social housing waitlists are high and increasing, with 24,571 households waiting for social housing. This includes 122,457 priority cases, 12% up from the previous year.
Across Australia, 3.2 million people are at risk of losing their home from just one event, like a rent increase, a job loss, relationship breakdown, or unforeseen expenses.
Poverty is also rising, with one in six Australian children living in poverty, according to the Australian Council of Social Service report of October 2025.
Even those with full-time, well-paid jobs are increasingly in financial difficulty. Mental Health Australia's 2023 report to the nation found that over half Australians believe the rising cost of living is having a significant impact on their mental health.
The stress resulting from the rising cost of groceries, rent or mortgage payments, utilities, and general economic uncertainty is leading to increased levels of family breakdown, crime, anxiety, depression, and other mental health-related concerns.
The Black Dog Institute reports that young Australians are experiencing mental illness at an alarming rate, with almost 40% being affected. This is a 50% increase over the last 14 years.
Australia has massive reserves of natural resources. Recent figures show that the annual value of coal exports was $91 billion, iron ore $138 billion, liquefied natural gas $73 billion, oil and gas $76.8 billion, and gold and non-ferrous metals $33 billion. Australia exports seven times as much as it imports. This money goes not into government revenue, but into the accounts of mostly US-owned transnational corporations who pay little or no tax. Bevan, how much benefit do the Australian people receive from this?
Unfortunately, very little. For example, take the export of liquefied natural gas. Qatar exported 100 billion cubic metres of LNG annually for a return to its government of $26.6 billion. Australia exports a similar amount of LNG annually for a paltry return to our government of $0.8 billion. I'll repeat that, $26 billion against $0.8 billion.
Bevan, why is it that the Australian people benefit so little from our natural resource wealth?
I believe the answer lies in successive governments' open-door encouragement to foreign investors, allowing a virtual takeover, control, and indeed rapacious exploitation of our natural resources for their benefit, not ours. Professor Clinton Fernandes, writing in The Conversation, April 2, 2020, said that right now US corporations eclipse everyone else in their ability to influence our politics through their investments in Australian stocks. Using company ownership data from Bloomberg, I analysed the ownership of Australia's 20 biggest companies a few days after the 2019 federal election in May. Of those 20, 15 were majority owned by US-based investors. Three more were at least 25% US-owned.
The list includes the following: Commonwealth Bank of Australia, once the People's Bank, but since privatisation, 62% US-owned. The BHP Group, once the Big Australian, now 73% US-owned. Westpac Bank, 64% US-owned. National Australia Bank, 63% US-owned. ANZ Bank, 54% US-owned. Woolworths, 66% US-owned. Rio Tinto, 65% US-owned. Wesfarmers, 56% US-owned, and the list goes on.
The Australia Institute has produced figures similar to those of Professor Fernandes, but with even higher levels of US ownership.
The financial clout and industry dominance of these corporations means that decisions about industry investment and development are made not by the Australian government, but in corporate boardrooms, mostly overseas. These decisions are made to maximise profit for their shareholders, the corporation's prime responsibility, and the Australian people miss out.
The classic case is the car manufacturing industry. Successive Australian governments allowed foreign corporations to increase their penetration until they had 100% control of car manufacturing in Australia. The government thus forfeited any ability to exercise control over this industry. And when the foreign owners decided they could make higher profits overseas, the entire industry was closed down. We lost a major part of our manufacturing industry, along with the jobs and the skills that went with it.
We also lose out because of tax manipulation, so-called creative accounting. Clinton Fernandes, in his excellent book Ireland Off the Coast of Asia, writes that, and I quote, "Recent work by investigative journalist Michael West and the Tax Justice Network have exposed the myriad ways in which certain corporations get around the tax laws. ExxonMobil, for instance, paid zero tax on more than $18 billion in income in 2014 to 15, although the price of domestic gas went through the roof. Figures released in December 2017 showed that Glencore, which operates in commodity industries such as coal, copper, oil and zinc, managed to exterminate all profit and tax on $22 billion in income. Shell Australia paid zero on $4.2 billion in revenue. Chevron, nothing on $2.1 billion. Viva Energy, which bought the petrol stations from Shell, zero tax on $16.8 billion. And ExxonMobil, not a cent on $6.7 billion, end of quote.
In short, one Australian worker paid more tax than five giant US corporations whose combined income in that year was $51.8 billion.
Professor Fernandes highlights Norway's alternative approach to development of its energy resources, which allows it to maintain sovereign control for the benefit of its people. He says that, quote, "Norway harnessed its earnings from oil and gas in its continental shelf. The Norwegian government is the largest shareholder in Statoil, its state oil company. The Norwegian government created Oljefondet, or the Oil Fund, in 1990 to invest Norway's oil revenue. The fund had more than 11 billion kroner, or 1.7 trillion Australian dollars, in 2021. This was a handsome investment for a country with 5.5 million people. End of quote. Largely because of this, Norway has one of the highest living standards in the world.
An attempt was made in 1972 to 1975 by the Whitlam ALP government to reverse foreign ownership and control and regain government ownership of our mineral resources. This was an effort led by Minister for Minerals and Energy, Rex Connor. For this, and for questioning CIA involvement in Pine Gap, the Whitlam government was dismissed by the Governor General in a US instigated coup.
Recently, the Australia Institute and a number of community organisations, including the ACTU, called for a 25% tax to be imposed on the export of Australia's liquefied natural gas. This would end the gas shortages being engineered by the gas industry, cut gas prices, and deliver a $12.5 billion revenue windfall for Australian industry and households. The Albanese government rejected this proposal.
The proposal by the Australian Citizens Party to re-establish a government-owned People's Bank using the Australia Post network has also received a negative response from the federal government.
In 2024, the then Greens leader, Adam Bandt, announced plans for a supersized tax to target big business, arguing that the government could take more than $500 billion from the private sector to fund a rent freeze, make childcare free, eliminate student debt, and cover dentistry through Medicare. This proposal also received a negative response from the government.
Successive Australian governments have forfeited sovereign control of the economy and the ability to set national economic priorities, resulting in the Australian people being robbed of the benefits of our national wealth. The defence against foreign ownership and control is publicly owned enterprises. That ownership could be regained through the compulsory acquisition powers provided in the Constitution, using the existing power of the legislature, S5131, to acquire property on just terms.
Parliament does have the power to nationalise, in whole or in part, critical national industries and provide compensation for the acquisition. It's just a question of a government deciding to prioritise the interests of the Australian people over those of the corporations, and having the courage and foresight to press ahead and do so.
Andrew, we Australians are being taken to the cleaners. We are not getting a fair share of this country's immense wealth, which could otherwise provide us with world-class infrastructure, including affordable housing and transport, as well as free healthcare, education and childcare. This would remove the economic stresses presently causing so much hardship and mental health issues, and help us address the existential issues associated with the climate crisis.
Quite right. We need to break free from US and other foreign domination of our economy, regain ownership and control of our strategic and wealth-generating industries, and use that wealth for the benefit of the Australian people. Time to break free from the US is the theme of IPAN's upcoming national conference in Adelaide from the 24th to the 26th of July. To register, go to IPAN's website at www.ipan.org.au. And that brings us to the end of this IPAN podcast. Good day and thanks for listening.